Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Sound check, 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 check. Sound check, 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 check. Sound check.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Ever wonder why people sing in the shower, even people who won't sing anywhere else? It's because singing sounds good in most bathrooms. All that tile and porcelain and glass makes for a nice, reverberant space. It's the same reason you probably don't sing in an elevator, even though it might be a similar size. It's just not a place where music's gonna sound good. Having said that, sometimes it can actually be fun to try and force music into a place where it doesn't really belong. Here, listen to this.
Picture the type of place.
That's Wall, the name used by a young English singer-songwriter, and that's her performing in the back of one of those big old black taxicabs that they have in London. It's part of a long-running online series called The Black Cab Sessions. Now, if Wall can sound that good with her trio crammed into the back of a taxi, which, by the way, is moving through the streets of East London as they play, imagine how good they're going to sound when they play for us in our spiffy studio in just a bit. Who knows, maybe they'll get the sound check bump and find themselves playing on the arena circuit with rock's biggest names. You know, like, who even are rock's biggest names today? Oh, wait, I know one. In just over a year's time, Dave Grohl has won 5 Grammys for his latest Foo Fighters album, which you're hearing in the background. He's released the documentary Sound City, reunited the other surviving members of Nirvana to rock SNL with Paul McCartney, and delivered the keynote address at the South by Southwest Festival. I think it's okay to say that Dave Grohl is having a moment. And that's why we've called on Paul Branigan, author of the biography This Is a Call, The Life and Times of Dave Grohl. He joins us from the studios of the BBC in London. Hi, Paul.
Hi, John. How are you?
Good. So you're just back from South by Southwest yourself, right?
Yeah, I just returned yesterday, so slightly frazzled and jet-lagged, but another fun week.
All right. I want to play a clip from Dave Grohl's keynote address and then get your opinion of this. This is Dave Grohl in Austin, Texas at last week's South by Southwest Festival.
As an artist raised in the ethically suffocating punk rock underground, conditioned to reject conformity, to resist all corporate influence and expectation, where do you go? How do you deal with that kind of success? How do you now define success? Is it still the reward of playing a song from beginning to end without making a mistake? Is it still finding that new chord or scale that makes you forget all of your troubles? How do you process going from being one of us to one of them? Guilt. Guilt is cancer. It will confine you, torture you, destroy you as an artist.
Dave Grohl at the South by Southwest Festival. Paul, those are pretty strong words.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously Dave grew up in two very, very strong ideological punk rock scenes, the Washington, D.C. scene based around Discord Records, and then the Seattle underground scene based around Sub Pop. And there was a lot of rules in those communities, a lot of do's and don'ts. And he was someone who never really played by those rules and tried to stay outside it. And I think his idea of punk rock back then was having the freedom to do whatever you want to do. Mm-hmm. And that's something that he's really maintained, you know, throughout his career, which is why he's been able to have the incredible 12 months that you mentioned at the start of the show.
Yeah. To say nothing of the 20-odd years before the last 12 months.
Indeed.
Nirvana coming out of that Seattle scene and going on to huge commercial success. He talks there about guilt, you know, that guilt is cancer for a musician. If you feel bad about your success, how do you do anything with that is the question that he asks. Do you see Dave Grohl kind of stepping into a central and important role in the rock world, both for fans and for other musicians right now?
Well, I think so. I mean, you know, you speak with people, you know, music fans and musicians alike, and they really regard Dave as pretty much a musician of unimpeachable integrity. He's someone who's done his own thing, carved his own path. You know, he owned his own record label. He's his own boss. He's now made his own documentary. So everything he's done since 1995 has been entirely off his own bat. And obviously he's had huge success with that. And, you know, people can take whatever view they want on the Foo Fighters, you know, about how commercial that band is. But at the end of the day, I don't think Dave Grohl's ever made a single step in his life that he didn't like. Certainly not, you know, Nirvana was a different story because he always maintained it wasn't his band. He was just the drummer. That was his line in every business meeting they had. And so he was able to sort of sit in within that world, but also slightly apart, and sort of see how, you know, the contradictions of what Kurt believed in sort of tore him apart and made things difficult for him.
Kurt Cobain, of course, yeah.
Yes, sorry. So I think, yeah, he's now sort of stepped up with a degree of responsibility. He's now become, you know, he's doing this more than for himself, I think, at the moment. Sound City is his sort of gift almost to the next generation of musicians.
Well, I want to get to Sound City in just a bit, but we're talking about Dave Grohl, who most of our listeners will know from two bands. First, Nirvana, and then Foo Fighters. Here's something from each. Dave Grohl's second band, Foo Fighters, with This Is a Call. We're speaking with Paul Branigan, author of the book This Is a Call, The Life and Times of Dave Grohl, now out in paperback. Paul, obviously your decision to name your biography of Dave after this song, there must be something in the song that you feel is emblematic of his career?
Yes, well, it was the first single that the Foo Fighters put out, so I guess it's the first time that most people in the world heard of Dave Grohl as a frontman.
Mm-hmm.
But also that chorus, you know, This Is a Call to My Past Resignations, it was sort of his statement, of mission statement almost from the start. I mean, Dave had played in punk rock bands since he was 13, 14 years of age, and he'd been recording stuff on his own since then, and a lot of the songs that made up the first Foo Fighters album he had demoed 20, 30 times in his friends', you know, basement studios in Arlington, Virginia. And I think this was his sort of mission statement, saying, right, enough is enough, I'm taking control of my own life, having been sat in the background for so many bands and watched things happen to other people and watched scenes change and people change. And this was his, you know, cathartic statement for himself.
Mm-hmm. How much of a catharsis was the period following Kurt Cobain's death? I mean, how did he kind of pick up the pieces and make the decision to go on?
Well, I think, you know, for maybe 6 months or 9 months afterwards, he absolutely retreated into his own life. You know, he was married at the time to a girl called Jennifer Youngblood. He'd got us a lot of friends in Seattle, and he sort of retreated into that community, which is a very tight-knit community. And a lot of those people obviously knew Kurt Cobain a lot better than he did, potentially, or at least for a lot longer than he did. And I think that making this album, the first Foo Fighters album, was just his way of trying to sort of snap out of it and remind himself what it is that he does, you know, what it is that he was good at. And, you know, he's always maintained that the first Foo Fighters album wasn't intended to be an album at all. It was merely just a little reward for him. You know, he would go in there, he would record 12 songs with his friend in the studio, which was literally 200 yards from his house. And he would get that demo tape and he would listen to it, and it would remind him, you know, that there's joy in music and there's happiness in music. Because, you know, at a point for the previous, you know, few years before that, there didn't seem to be an awful lot of joy in Nirvana's world.
Yeah. Now this sort of goes to something else that Dave Grohl talked about in his keynote address at the South by Southwest Festival in Austin last week. This, once again, is Dave Grohl.
I can truthfully say out loud that Gangnam Style is one of my favorite songs of the past decade. It is. Is it any better or worse than the latest Atoms for Peace album? If only we had a celebrity panel of judges to determine that for us. What would J-Lo do? Paging Pitchfork, come in, Pitchfork. We need you to help us determine the value of a song. Who cares?
So the idea, Paul Branigan, that Dave Grohl seems to be taking aim at here is the idea of the guilty pleasure. You know, that you should feel bad for liking a song or music that is not cool.
Yeah, well, I absolutely know that Dave hates the idea of the guilty pleasure, and I actually hate the idea of the guilty pleasure too. I really don't understand the concept of it. I know the concept, but I don't recognize the reality of it. His thing was, you know, he talked to me for the book when he talked about Kurt. He talked about how Kurt loved ABBA, and they would, you know, listen to ABBA all the time in Nirvana's tour van, and they would listen to heavy metal even though Nirvana were supposed to be out to kill heavy metal, and they would listen to Evel Knievel cassettes, and they would do all this silly stuff that they would listen to in the back of a van, but then they would have to come out and talk to people all day about the big crusades that they were on, and, you know, how it was important to kill stupid music and to kill Guns N' Roses and to do this, that and the other. And I think it just got sort of, you know, from Dave's point of view, it was, you know, a little wearing and a little confusing as to why you'd be one thing, you know, when you're with your friends, and then another thing entirely when put in front of a microphone.
Yeah. Now, there is this sort of nickname that's been associated with Dave Grohl, the nicest guy in rock. Is he?
Well, it's hard to find a nicer guy, but I think beneath that sort of handy epithet, you know, Dave's got quite a sort of strong heart. And, you know, he's gone through his career, you know, particularly his sort of teenage career. He wouldn't just play music with anyone. You know, he wanted people who were good. He wanted people who had ambition. He wanted people who had got some sort of sense of what they were doing. And I think through his life, he's made some sort of quite difficult decisions. I mean, he's let friends go from the Foo Fighters, and he's stepped in and made, you know, some unpopular decisions when they weren't entirely didn't necessarily make that much business sense, or didn't necessarily make that much commercial sense for someone. But to him, it was absolutely the right thing to do. So he has got this sort of, the steel fist beneath the iron glove. Or beneath the iron glove, it doesn't even make sense.
The steel fist, the velvet glove.
Velvet glove. Yeah, that's better. Thank you. And, you know, he's sort of maintained that. But I mean, if you spent an evening with him, you would have a fabulous time. But I think it's, you know, getting really to the core of the man. You know, there is a sort of a steeliness in there that people perhaps underestimate.
Well, now, when we get to, you alluded to Sound City before. Here we find, you know, the Dave Grohl who is both a fan and a guy who is willing to stand up and do something that seems kind of unusual and, you know, sort of against the flow of the music industry because it's what he wants. Tell us the story about Sound City, this recording studio in California.
Well, Sound City for Dave started off as the studio where Nirvana made the Nevermind album. And, you know, he talked about going down there and what a grotty studio it was. But then, he was expecting this fancy major label studio in the heart of the entertainment industry. And they got there and it's like, wow, this is like the barn we practice in. But in walking down the corridor towards the main sort of sound rooms, you know, he was passing albums by Dio and Rick Springfield and Tom Petty and people like this. And, you know, some of the albums that he had got in his own collection. And he realized that there was a magic in this place. And obviously, the 2 weeks and 2.5 weeks that Nirvana spent in Sound City changed Dave Grohl's life forever. And I think for him, this sort of mission statement, once this place closed and he ended up buying the sound desk because it wasn't really a viable commercial property in the age of Pro Tools and digital recording. He sort of thought about some of those records that had meant a lot to him growing up and thought about how Nevermind had meant a lot to a new generation of kids. And I think he wanted to sort of tell a story about how music changes lives and how art is important and how doing something from your heart rather than for commercial value has still got a real value at a time when, you know, perhaps the record label is under siege a little bit and, you know, people are more desperate than ever to turn profits.
So Sound City is where Fleetwood Mac recorded when Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks joined the band. It's where Neil Young did After the Gold Rush, Nirvana with Nevermind. So when Dave Grohl makes this documentary, it begins kind of as a valentine to this place. Analog Studios, you mentioned the board, the analog board that he actually bought, and it's in his, what, it's in his garage now, right?
It's actually in his sort of recording complex. They've got a place called Studio 606 in Northridge, California.
Mm-hmm. Here's Dave Grohl near the end of the documentary talking about why he took on this Sound City project.
It all started with this idea that I wanted to tell the story of the board. The conversation became something much bigger. Like, in this age of technology, where you can simulate or manipulate anything, how do we retain that human element? How do we keep music to sound like people? That feeling that I got when I was young, oh, I could do that too.
Paul Branigan, author of This Is a Call, The Life and Times of Dave Grohl. What do you think of this movie, Sound City?
I think it's a really excellent movie. You know, I've seen it twice now, and I've owned a copy of it. And I think it's a really inspirational movie, really, in the same way that Dave Grohl's career is quite inspirational. You know, it shows you that making music for fun and making music for pleasure is still an important thing. And it's, you know, you watch this sort of cast of people from Neil Young through to Stevie Nicks to Tom Petty to the guys from Rage Against the Machine to Lars from Metallica. And they, you know, they all have the same sort of stories. They're talking about childhood. They're talking about their first bands. They're talking about how magic it felt to hold the first vinyl record in their hands and, you know, how much it meant to them to sort of inspire people. And it's, you know, it's a really nice story. And then the final part, the sort of, it's almost like a three-act play. Mm. You know, the first part tells the story, the history of it from Fleetwood Mac through to Tom Petty. The second bit sort of captures the 90s revolution where basically after Nevermind was recorded there and obviously was a phenomenal success, selling, what, 15 million in US alone, that every alternative band in America was suddenly dispatched off to Sound City, Sound City to capture that same magic. And then the final bit of it is, you know, after he's installed this famous analog Neve board in his own rehearsal space, to try and sort of reunite some of the people who had made music on the desk and to try and sort of give it a relevance to now. And it's quite touching, really, how, you know, how affected people are. The likes of Tom Petty's coming in, sort of stroking, you know, the board, and Stevie Nicks, you know, looking at it and, you know, reading out letters from Sound City back. She was writing back to her parents right at the start of Fleetwood Mac. And it's really nice to see how much these things still mean to people. And some of the music they make is also fantastic. So it sort of shows the, you know, the continuity, and it's quite a sort of, it ends on quite a powerful note with Paul McCartney being in there. And Paul McCartney was the guy who essentially taught Dave Grohl how to play music. He sat down with the two Beatles albums, the Red Greatest Hits and the Blue Greatest Hits album, and the Beatles songbook, and that's how he figured out guitar. Mm. So you see him all these years later in a room with McCartney, hugging him and congratulating him on the, you know, the song they're doing together. And it's quite a sweet little tale. I think if you've no interest in music whatsoever, you'd still find it inspirational. But if you, you know, have any sort of heart attuned to the guitar chords at all, then, you know, you'll practically be in tears watching it.
So I guess, you know, people listening to this list of great names in the music world, all, you know, talking about how much they love this soundboard and the Sound City studio, are probably going to be wondering, if everybody loved it, why did it go under? Why, you know, why does that soundboard no longer exist? Why does that studio no longer exist?
Well, I guess people, I mean, you know, the shift to digital technology from analog was obviously that's the simple answer.
Yeah.
But I mean, I guess musicians too are, you know, they're like there's a childlike quality to musicians. And when all the new technology came in, a lot of those people got really excited about the chance to work with these new products. You know, that you'd see Tom Petty in there, and he's talking about, you know, what a Fairlight synthesizer could do. And I guess they got a little distracted at a point. You know, there was these new toys and it made things easier. And suddenly you didn't have to do 128 takes of Damn the Torpedoes. You know, you could go in there and you could correct things in a couple of days. And, you know, budgets got tighter from the labels, and people's touring plans got extended as they got more popular. And it sort of, you know, people got distracted, I think, and they sort of forgot that analog almost existed for, you know, a good 10 to 15 years.
Well, and it's worth pointing out, you know, Dave Grohl made his fair share of digital recordings, has his own digital studio. And in this Sound City reel-to-reel album that he put together with some of the musicians you mentioned who are in the documentary, he's teamed up here with Josh Homme from Queens of the Stone Age and Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails, who is a big digital fan, but who seems quite at home in this analog recording from Dave Grohl's Sound City project. Mantra from Sound City, Reel to Reel. That is the album that Dave Grohl has produced in association with his recent documentary about Sound City Recording Studio, which closed in 2011. And as Paul Branigan, his biographer, has been telling us, Dave Grohl actually bought the old analog soundboard from that studio, now has it in his own studio. And Trent Reznor helping out there on lead vocals. Worth mentioning, Dave Grohl back behind the drum kit on that song that we just heard. So he still occasionally does, you know, sort of put down the guitar and get back behind the drums, Paul. But nowadays, I guess we really think of him as a front man, don't we?
We do. And I think it's taken him quite a long time to think of himself as a front man. I mean, he was always a drummer. And even the way he plays guitar, he thinks like a drummer. He's got a sort of percussive element to his guitar playing. But he had a chance to sort of go behind the drums again to do the Them Crooked Vultures project with Josh Homme and John Paul Jones. And I think that sort of reignited his love of playing drums. And, you know, the Foo Fighters, he doesn't have that option anymore. He's got a fantastic drummer and he's out front whether he likes it or not now. So, it has taken him a while to feel comfortable with that idea. But, you know, he's a multi-talented guy and it's nice to see. I mean, people get a thrill out of seeing that. You know, when you see the band play live, he's got this Sound City Players, this sort of rolling collective of you know, 20 to 30 musicians who play shows, and they played at South by Southwest Festival too. And, you know, there's an undeniable thrill to see, you know, Dave Grohl pick up drumsticks and walk behind a drum kit and have Chris Novoselic, his old bandmate from Nirvana, walk on and lift up a bass and then have John Fogerty from CCR come out and start knocking out the chords to Fortunate Son. So, you know, if those sort of things don't thrill you, you may as well give up on music.
He has become one of the most visible figures in the rock field, and he is the subject of Paul Branigan's book, This Is a Call, The Life and Times of Dave Grohl. Paul's been with us from the studios of the BBC in London. Paul, nice talking with you. Thanks for being with us today.
It was a pleasure, John. Thanks for having me on.
This is Soundcheck.
Whisper all your secrets. screaming your confessions. Show me where you hide. Long your roots are lying deep within the dirt. Love already
That's a tune from the Sound City soundtrack called If I Were Me. It features Dave Grohl with violinist Jesse Green, keyboardist Rami Jaffe from the Wallflowers, and drummer Jim Keltner. Here a live performance from the up-and-coming British artist known as Wall. She's a singer, songwriter, and producer who's set to release an EP next month. Wall joins us next to play songs from it live. This is Soundcheck.
Seen in a magazine, left on a pavement, taking it underground, needed to save it.
I'm John Schaefer. Here at Soundcheck, we're big fans of the music video series known as the Black Cab Sessions. The concept is pretty simple. You take an artist, you stuff them into the back seat of one of those old black taxis in London, and then film them performing while the cab drives around. In the background, you're hearing the installment that features the British musician Lila Foy, who performs under the name Wall. We'll talk more about this session in a moment, but first, Wall and her band are going to perform in the slightly comfier confines of the Soundcheck studio. Here's a song called Shoestring.
Try to all that I know I've given in. I've given in. When for a breather made me a teaser.
Push me down, the animals have got.
That's the song Shoestring from the English artist known as Wall. That's Lila Foy singing and playing the electric guitar with Dan Bell on keyboards, Ollie Deacon on bass, both of them adding some backing vocals here in the Soundcheck studio. Lila, welcome.
Hi.
So the name Wall, is that like a musical persona name or is it a band name? How big a group of human beings is covered by this wall?
Well, it could be anything, but it's just the name of this project and these songs. And I was starting to write in a slightly different way, so I thought it needed a sort of a name to define that.
Mm-hmm.
And so right now it's just three of us when we're playing live, and it's me writing the songs.
Okay. And you say you were starting to write in a slightly different way. Different from what?
Right, and different, how? I was performing in a couple of bands, and I was playing guitar, but I wanted to sort of break away from writing with guitar and also writing with the confines of a band. Mm-hmm. As a sort of, right, we have to play this with these particular instruments. So it was just starting to write with none of that there at the beginning.
Yeah.
And then when people started to listen to what we were doing and pick up on it, of course we had to form a live band, but it very much came from the recordings first, and then, right, how do we play this live?
So, you know, it's interesting. You said you didn't want to be, like, writing with the guitar and stuff. I mean, I've noticed that you can often tell when a composer is a guitarist because their harmonic sense will be slightly different from a composer who's a pianist.
Yeah.
So do you find that if you write on the guitar that you tend to fall into certain kind of patterns and stuff?
Absolutely. And I'm playing guitar now, but when I'm writing the songs, I'm normally starting with a very simple, like, organ drone or just a bass line or something that doesn't have too many melodic hints there. Mm-hmm. So that when I'm writing, there's no... It's not obvious what the melody's going to be from the chords.
Right. Because
with a guitar, if you're playing a normal, you know, chord progression, you can very much hear the melody that's there, so I'd rather take that away. And then I think it's made the melodies a little bit more creative and a little bit more imaginative.
So the melodies come from you and they're not suggested by the instrument all
exactly.
of a sudden.
Exactly, it makes you work a little bit harder, I think.
Oh, that's... Now, the I mentioned the Black Cab sessions in the introduction.
Mm-hmm.
You did the song Magazine in the back of one of those big black London taxis.
We did.
I'm hoping you were a little more comfy here in our studio today.
Absolutely.
What was that? I mean, for folks who have not, you know, seen the Black Cab sessions, it is literally, as I said, you know, you get picked up, you put in the back seat, and then what happens?
Well, we had a sort of sound check in the back of the cab, but all the while you have to remember that the meter's going as well.
Yeah.
So this could get quite expensive. And no, I mean, the back of a cab has never felt smaller, because when you go in them, you know, just on the way to a party or on the way home, feels pretty palatial. And yeah, not so much. I mean, Dan's playing with his pedals and various things, and it was so hot. It was midsummer's day. There was a light in our faces, and yeah, it was tiny. I think I had to sit in between Ollie's legs just to make it possible on one song.
So, and it has to be acoustic, right? Because you can't plug anything in.
No, we did actually plug. They have one. I think all our electronics were running through the cigarette lighter.
Oh.
So you can. I think that's what we did. Is that right? So we had. Yeah, we had some. We didn't actually play acoustic. We had the electric guitar and our keyboards, which aren't acoustic, but obviously the sound's coming out of there, out of the speakers. So it was a little bit of both, and our voices are obviously just into the cab, so it's. It's pretty stripped down, to say the least.
And what did your driver think of all this?
Oh, he was so sweet, Mark. Oh, he was lovely. He introduced us in his very London accent, and it was really sweet. He came to our first gig a few weeks after the session and came to say hi. Yeah.
Now, one of the reasons I mentioned the Black Cab sessions, not only because they're just such great ways of being introduced to bands. I first saw Johnny Flynn, in fact, in a black cab
section. Right, he was one of the first,
He was, I think, he might have actually been the first.
Yeah.
But now the folks who have done this, and by the way, they're in the cab with you with the camera and all that, so it's one very crowded London taxi cab. They've started a record label, and you are the first signing to that record label.
Indeed.
So is this going to be like an old school record label with, you know, contracts and touring, and or is it basically, are they leaving you to your own devices and just, you know, a place where you can release records?
Yeah, they've just been really helpful kind of with the setup, with sort of introducing us to the industry, and it's been nice to use like their contacts and also their kind of, people really respect them as a
As an entity.
As an entity, exactly.
Do they have a studio other than the back of a hurtling London taxi cab?
No, but luckily I record everything at home in my home studio, so I don't have to record in a cab, although it would make quite a nice office.
Yeah.
It would.
We're speaking with Lila Foy, who records under the name Wall, and so you've been writing your own pieces. You've turned heads initially with some covers of songs from the 60s, like Where Did Our Love Go by the Supremes, the folk singer Karen Dalton, one of her songs called Something on Your Mind. So, you know, this is music that's way before you were born. What, is there something in the 60s that in that music that appeals to you?
Yeah, I love the 60s. I love all the music that came out of the 60s. And I think it's nice when you're doing a cover to sort of maybe not do something too contemporary, because you don't want to step on anyone's toes. And I like to do sort of very different versions, so it's not too similar, because otherwise I don't really see the point of the cover.
Right.
So I've sort of changed, I very much like changed the tempo, changed the feel. So with the Supremes cover, I straightened it up, so it's not sort of swingy anymore. It's kind of straight in the Wall style, which is all very much like very straight and regimented. The Karen Dalton cover, again, it's a lot more melancholy than the original.
Really? Because the original
it's quite
pretty sad stuff.
That's true. It is sad. Maybe even more sad. When I play it, I actually love playing it live, and I sometimes well up a little bit. Beautiful lyrics. I love that song.
But the new EP called Shoestring, which is out here on April 2nd, these are all original songs.
They're your songs. They're five songs, all our songs, yeah.
And how much of the playing on the record is you?
Most of that, but the guys are playing some bass and guitar and keyboard parts. But when I started writing the songs, I very much layered up stuff, and then the guys have come in, and now we're imagining how things are going to be live, so we're kind of thinking about that, and we know what our setup is now. So, it's nice to have everyone lending parts and stuff.
Well, speaking of live, Wall is performing for us here in our Soundcheck studio. You want to do Place Too Low next?
Yeah.
All right, it's another live performance from Wall here in the Soundcheck studio.
Tried to keep my thinking down, took some time to work it out. Never in a place too low, in a house up on a hill. Called out to me that I should know, with a whisper and a being so humming.
That is Wall, live on Soundcheck with a song called Place Too Low. The forthcoming EP is called Shoestring, and here's another song called All Alone. Once again, Wall, live in the Soundcheck studio. That is Wall, live on Soundcheck with the song All Alone. Once again, Wall is the name of the project of singer, songwriter, keyboardist, guitarist Lila Foy, with Dan Bell and Ollie Deacon helping out on keyboards, guitars, bass, backing vocals. And the new EP is called Shoestring, out in this country on April 2nd. So, Lila, you and the boys are here in the States in part because you went to the South by Southwest Festival recently.
Yeah.
How was that? Is this your first time in the States?
Not first time in the States, but first time playing and first time playing with these guys here. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
So how did South by go?
It was great. It was a whirlwind. It was crazy.
How many shows?
Six shows. Yeah. One day we had three, so we were just in the van, unloading on stage, loading the van. You know, it's just.
Did you get any time to see anything?
We saw a couple of things. We had, on our last night at South By, we played at the Central Presbyterian Church, which is a beautiful venue, and we were lucky enough to play with Devendra Banhart. And
who was our on-the-scene reporter?
I heard. I heard about that.
And he didn't realize that was going to happen, but we pressed him into duty, and the results were somewhat comical, but
he's a funny man.
And Iron and Wine, who will be joining us next month, were also on that bill.
Yeah.
And the Milk Carton Kids, who were here recently. So now we've got all of you from that Central Presbyterian Church thing.
So that was a real highlight. That was a brilliant show.
Mm-hmm.
And
so what happens now? The EP will come out. Does that herald a full length at some point?
At some point. When we get back from this trip, going to sort of finish that in earnest, sort of finish writing all the songs. I've got, I'd say, half of the songs ready, so I need to do a little bit more work. And before the festival season kicks off, I just need to lock myself away behind closed doors and get that sorted, done.
Well, Lila Foy, Wall, the EP, Shoestring, does come out here on April 2nd. Lila, to you and Dan and Ollie, thank you so much for coming in and playing for us this afternoon. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you for having us.
This is Soundcheck.
Leaving hell behind me, stepped out from the road that ended, drew out another ending made. It's a big deal, it's important to me. Showed up to be over again. I've tried a long time to meet you. He don't think I'd give much to see you.
If you like the in-studio performances you hear on the show and you're looking for a way to slack off at work during the afternoon, Soundcheck webcasts are recording sessions live as they happen almost every day at 2 p.m., join us online this Monday at 2 for a live audio stream of a performance from Tao and the Get Down, Stay Down. Their new album is called We the Common, and here's a song from it called We Don't Call.
We don't call, we don't write. We love some strangers every night, oh no. Closest ones too sad to warn. They don't mean much, but they don't mean harm. Oh no. Well, bye bye, baby, I'm going to work. Chase myself all over the earth. Do we leave too long? Do you wait too much?
That's the band Tao and the Get Down, Stay Down. And that song is We Don't Call from their new album, We the Common. Join us online to hear Tao and the Get Down, Stay Down record a session for an upcoming edition of Soundcheck this Monday online at 2 p.m. at soundcheck.org. Coming up, it's a gig alert. Hear music from the singer-songwriter Margaret Glasby before she plays out in New York next week. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Before we go tonight, here's a track from next week's Gig Alerts. If you listen to Morning Edition here on WNYC, or if you're a regular visitor to soundcheck.org, you know that we preview an upcoming gig each day and give you a free MP3 from the band. This week, we think that singer-songwriter Margaret Glaspie is someone you should hear about. She draws inspiration from artists like Jeff Buckley, Nina Simone, and Lauryn Hill. Her raspy, emotive voice seems to channel the best of all of those influences. She's playing on Tuesday night at the Cornelia Street Cafe in Greenwich Village, and here's the track, Who Said, from her new EP called If and When.
Who said I was on my own tonight? What made you think that I was on my own? 'Cause I'm not, I've got a man waiting for me.
That's Margaret Glaspie with Who Said. It comes from her EP, If and When. She's playing at the Cornelia Street Cafe on Tuesday, and you can read more about her. Just click on Gig Alerts at soundcheck.org. That's going to do it for the show today. On Monday, a visit from Mike Scott, the Scottish-born guitarist and singer behind the Celtic-tinged rock band known as the Waterboys. Their 10th album is based on the poetry of W.B. Yeats, and the Waterboys will play a special acoustic session for us. Plus, the circus is in town. We'll talk with the composer behind the music of the Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus, running now in Brooklyn. And our staff picks our favorite circus-inspired pop music. Got one yourself? Tell us about it at 866-939-1612. Or email us, soundcheck@WNYC.org. The number again, 866-939-1612. We're looking for circus-themed pop songs for Monday's show. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC and New York Public Radio. Our technical director is Irene Trudell. Our engineering team includes Paul Schneider, George Wellington, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Greta Cohn and Katie Bishop with Alex Kappelman. Our web ninja is Mike Katziff. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.